Well, David Harris galvanized a generation into political action. His opposition to the Vietnam War made it acceptable for some to question, protest, and resist U.S. involvement in the war. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, David Harris joins us to discuss his new book, Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us. He is a respected journalist and author of many other books, but he has remained largely silent regarding the anti-war movement since the anti-war movement. In this new book, he directly addresses those whose lives touched or have been touched by the Vietnam War, perhaps our most divisive. Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us, is published by Times Books. The book is part critical history, part personal memoir, part personal reflection. It looks at how America's moral compass veered off course as a result of Vietnam. In the book, the writer calls for nothing less than a national reckoning. It's his assertion that only by facing up to and taking responsibility for what we did so many years ago in the tall grass can we finally regain our direction as a people and a country. David Harris, welcome to the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Well, we're glad you're with us today, and we're hoping that those in the audience this afternoon might have questions or comments, and that they will join us as well by calling 333-9455, 333 in the WILL local area, the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number good anywhere outside of the area in Illinois or Indiana, 800-222-9455. Again, the number's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Well, I think people know that you were a very vocal opponent to the war in Vietnam. In fact, serving some time in prison for turning in your draft card. But really, since the war ended and the anti-war movement sort of died off, you haven't been very vocal about that period. Why did you choose now to write about the war and your involvement in the anti-war movement and about what the war did to the country? Why did it take you so many years to get that down on paper?
I think, like all of us in the anti-war movement, there was kind of this implicit assumption that once it was all over, that there was kind of an automatic process that would take over somehow, and that history would demand that we make some kind of reckoning of what we did, and that would happen. And it's kind of this implicit assumption, and like all members of the anti-war movement, when it was over, I wanted to get on. You know, I had spent almost 10 years of my life being an organizer against the war and spent two of those years in federal prison, and I was ready to have something else to my life than just the war. So I think it was easy to drop it at that point and try to move on and let it settle and see what happened. And now, having turned 50, and I think my assumptions that somehow we would automatically come to terms with this obviously were mistaken. Far from that, that a kind of denial and avoidance has galvanized itself into a revisionism that makes the war seem something much less than what it was, and certainly does not advance the issue of our accountability at all. And I think that there are things in life that all people must come to terms with, and particularly their own behavior, and that going 10,000 miles from home and killing 3 million people for no good reason is something that you must account for, that all of us must. This is a kind of moral law, and that if we don't, then it automatically simply continues to lessen ourselves, and this is not something we can afford. You know, if we ever want to get past this war, then what we've got to do is admit what it was.
Did I understand you correctly to say that you're surprised, or you didn't expect that there would not be this accounting, or there would not be this reckoning?
I kind of assumed that there would be an accounting. You know, there was just this, if I had been questioned in detail about it, I'm not sure what answer I would have given, but, you know, there was this kind of implicit assumption that, well, you know, once the smoke lifts, it's, you know, what it was is going to be obvious, and that we will inevitably face up to it, and that didn't happen. We didn't face up to it, although I think what it was is in many ways obvious, but the facing up to it has not been nearly as simple a process as we once thought it would be.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, because I think it's really hard for people to face up to this kind of stuff. People don't want to hear it. This is not welcome information. even though it's quite old information. But Americans have a certain image of themselves and are not content with things that contradict that image. You know, we want to believe that we are the good and true and the land of the brave and home of the free, and we want that image of ourselves to be foremost in our vision of who we are. And the Vietnam War absolutely contradicts us. We were not the good guys. We were the bad guys. You know, my generation grew up with the model of World War II in front of us and the despicable behavior of the Germans and the Japanese in the course of that conflict was always held up as a model. It's the irony that 20 years later, my generation was then sent off to do things that we punished the Japanese and Germans for doing at the end of World War II. You know, that what we considered crimes in the hands of other people were just as criminal in our own hands, but we have yet to face up to that. And because we don't want to believe that we're capable of those things. We don't want to think that Americans can be evil, but in fact, Americans can be evil. And you know, if it's going to be our country right or wrong, then we're going to have to admit that it is indeed both of those things and can be both of those things and has been both of those things. And there's no better example of America having been wrong than our adventure in Southeast Asia.
I think sometimes the simplest statements can often perhaps, if not change the way people think, at least make them think about things in a little bit different way. And I think with this war, one of those things is that we always called it the Vietnam War, but of course, if you go to Vietnam, they call it the American War.
It's one of the points I make in the book. One of the ways to address this is really to start giving it its proper name, and to call this the Vietnam War somehow assumes that the Vietnamese were responsible for it. The Vietnamese simply happened to be in the intersection when we rolled up. I mean, this was our war. This was a war that would not have happened had not the United States of America decided to make it. And our decision to do so inevitably locked us into a set of moral consequences that we are still grappling with today. You know, this was all about us. You know, this was our projection on the universe that ended up killing 3 million people. And if we want to make sense out of it and make sense out of ourselves, then we're going to have to look at it straight in the face for once and admit that indeed this was a crime against everything our country's supposed to stand for, and accept that we in fact behave that way, and it will make it much easier to avoid the next time around. But if we don't face up to it, then we are going to be stuck kidding ourselves ad infinitum.
David Harris is my guest on the Afternoon Magazine today. He's author of Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us. It's published by Times Books. If you would like to speak with him this afternoon, give us a call at 333-9455, 333-WILL, or 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And we do have a caller on line number one from Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, Mr. Harris, with all due respect to your intense effort and personal sacrifice over the years, I still have a comment and a frustration with your generation. I'm 34, and of course I was a kid when all this went on, and then I went to college in the Reagan era. But I have a real great frustration with the veterans, whether they be on the campuses or the soldiers of Vietnam, being so quiet during this age where foreign policy continues to be a covert mystery. And I cite the Persian Gulf War as a prime example, where we had the strange dichotomy of either being a protester or a supporter of the troops, and real no sophistication to be able to differentiate between supporting the troops and still being against wars fought on poorly reasoned policy. And also the fact that your generation seems very quiet with regards to the drug war, that getting off drugs doesn't necessarily have to be a criminalized procedure. And, you know, do you feel a similar frustration at just the basic non-involvement amongst people that really did care, used to care, but don't seem to be very much heard anymore?
Well, I don't know that if it's frustration or what it is, but I certainly recognize the truth of what you're saying. I think part of that is just life tends to draw people away, and into a lot more complexities than they once imagined would ever cling to their lives. But I think certainly that differentiation you talk about between being able to separate the notion of supporting our troops and making that an automatic endorsement of whatever government policy is designed to spend those troops is one of the great chinks in the American armor to this day. You know, we are still, you know, and the Gulf War, I think, was a classic example of this, that the government has always arranged itself so that it will use the fact that it has young men out in harm's way as a way of manipulating and controlling its own domestic opposition. I mean, this was one of its primary tactics during the Vietnam War, and is obviously something that continued during the Gulf War that I think confuses all of us, unfortunately, that it is possible to separate the war and the warrior. And while one can honor the sacrifice or the bravery or the intentions of that soldiers may bring to the conflict that they are used in, the fact that they are used does not automatically make it good. And the fact that they are Americans being used in it does not automatically make it good either. And our own unwillingness to recognize our own capacity to behave in an evil fashion is an extraordinary danger to democracy and our own capacity to defend our democracy. So, you know, I certainly wish that when the Gulf War had arisen, that people had maintained the kind of perspective that they had apparently had up until that point.
Two quick follow-up questions. Do you think the media coverage of Vietnam influenced the decisions made by the Pentagon in the Persian Gulf War to censor basically the Persian Gulf War and turn it into a video light show? And also, I really question your premise that somehow two kids end civic responsibility, that having children or getting on with economic responsibilities ends people's civic responsibility.
Well, I certainly don't. I wasn't trying to make that case at all.
Okay.
I think getting a complicated life only helps you understand what happened to people. It doesn't provide excuses for not living up to one's responsibilities. And I certainly think whatever the age, all Americans are responsible for what happens in the country and ought to exercise that responsibility. You know, I can only speak for myself in that.
Right. I'm not questioning your efforts or sacrifices. I'm just saying, as a whole, it's very surprising that your generation would stand by and watch a censored war, say, in 1990.
Yeah, I think, you know, that certainly there were people who spoke out, but I agree. You know, I think part of that also is because we as a culture have not looked at the lessons that we ought to have learned then. I mean, our generation hasn't. We didn't honor our own lessons and the things that we learned because the war ended on such a down note, and people were so anxious to get on with their lives, and they walked off and didn't bother to incorporate those lessons into the ongoing legend of America. And as a consequence, those lessons have not been learned. And I certainly think that my generation ought to rise up at this point and say, "Hey, let's learn these lessons once and for all and get on with it."
If I could just ask the caller a question. I mean, you said you were 34.
Right.
Are you looking for anybody from your own generation to do some of the things that you're talking about?
Well, certainly.
Anybody, I guess?
Yeah, that's a good question. There doesn't seem to be, you know, if you want to consider George Stephanopoulos a leader for our, you know, age bracket, I don't think so. I really am frustrated that there isn't that sort of political concern or that social empathy that the kids in the 60s had. And certainly, you ask any veteran of around this town that the U of I campus is a totally different place to be than it was, say, in 69 and 68. And, there doesn't seem to be.
Seems interesting that you would still be looking for leadership in this area from the generation that protested against the war. I think that's interesting.
Well, the baby boomers do represent the most powerful bloc on, as far as voting, as far as economic power, and certainly they're in the prime of their adulthood, in a sense, of providing that leadership role. But if you talk to a 50-year-old politician, they're exactly the same kind of 50-year-old politician there was back in, you know, the Vietnam era. So there seems to be a...
Bill Clinton being the case in point.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to either power corrupts or we, as you said, Mr. Harris, we have completely forgotten and repressed the lessons that were learned or should have been learned.
Well, I think, you know, I think that we can't underestimate the power of avoidance and denial, you know, in this situation. You know, Americans want to believe everything's all right.
Yeah, and I mean, I think also, I mean, you never did address, and I think part of the Vietnam era was about illicit drug use and how that, this follow the government, whatever it says, and how that translates to today. I mean, I don't know if there should be a protest against the drug war or whatnot, but it certainly would, there should be some experience learned and some sort of veteran guidance as to how to really get off drugs.
Well, I certainly count myself amongst the critics of what we call the drug war. I mean, to me, you know, this is another example of government policy with a very big front and no real back. I mean, you know, that this is absurd. You know, trying to deal with the problem of drug addiction and use of dangerous drugs by American citizens using a war metaphor is absurd. You know, this is, you know, interdiction by the American forces are surrounding its borders is not going to stop this phenomenon. This, people don't use the drugs that people are worried about them using because they're part of some enemy force. I mean, people use these drugs because of needs they have in their own lives, and if you don't address those lives, then you're no further ahead, and you can't address those lives by making a punitive phenomenon. The notion that we can, on the one hand, pay farmers huge amounts of monies in order to subsidize the growing of tobacco, and on the other hand, send people off to jail for 5 and 10 years at a pop for possessing marijuana, makes no sense to me whatsoever. I think the war of drugs is a failure on drugs is a failure. A, because it's pursued its task with this blunt-edged instrument that has in many cases made absurd penalties for minor infractions. And on the other hand, it hasn't addressed why people use drugs in the first place. And, that we can spend millions and millions and millions of dollars patrolling our borders and not at the same time have readily available to anybody, any heroin addict who wants it, the possibility of cutting off heroin. I mean, in most states today, you have to go on a six-month waiting list just to get in a treatment program.
So where's the 50-year-olds protesting at the county courthouse or the county jail?
Well, they aren't out there, obviously. But, of course, there aren't anybody out there either, at least not the county courthouses around here. Maybe they're out there. But, I think that so many people are frightened of being having some stigma attached to them behind this issue that they are not prepared to make good sense about it. And certainly not to run a... You know, there's a kind of implicit McCarthyism, if you will, around this issue. That, if you stand up and say, look, I don't think all these drugs should be illegal, that we should be sending people to prison for this, it's tantamount to, you endorsing children dying of crack overdoses or whatever, So, I think... that my generation today and the whole country suffers from an unwillingness to speak up and to speak up if that's going to be unpopular and to say the king has no clothes.
So why were you able to do it 30 years ago?
Well, I think I would offer several reasons. I think the most obvious being the kind of direct stake people had in it. You know, this was not a abstract issue or an issue of policy for the people who dealt with the war. For most of us, this was a life or death issue. You know, for anybody between the ages of 18 and 26, when this war was going on, the possibility that they were going to end up being spent in it was a very real one. And so that touched people's lives in a way that didn't allow them to avoid the issue. You know, you couldn't just say, "Oh, I don't want to deal with this. I'm going to do something else." Because, the government come get you. And that forced people to come to terms with it in ways that they wouldn't have had to otherwise. I think that there was also a serious social movement that had begun in the civil rights movement in the early 1960s that stepped onto the issue of the war and that provided a sort of central core to organize an effort so that you could build a popular uprising against the war. But it had to be built. I mean, people, when they think back on the war, think of it as 1969 when there were, or 1970 when there were millions of people marching on Washington, D.C. In 1965, there weren't millions of people. There were just a few people. And those few people's willingness to be out there and to make a presence laid the base for what was to follow, and so the anti-war movement happened in that circumstance, and also I think it happened amongst a generation of people who at that point in time were much more prepared to take risks than many of the generations that followed them. I mean, people really were prepared to take their lives in their own hands, and the value of doing so was an understood in the culture that we participated in. That there was enormous gain to be made as a human being by going out and standing up for what you believed in was an accepted fact of the culture that I partook in. And that acceptance seems to have disappeared in large measure as well.
Thank you for your time.
Well, thanks for your call this afternoon. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455, the numbers to call this afternoon. David Harris is my guest on the program. His book is entitled Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us. It's published by Times Books. We have a caller on the toll-free line from Eureka this afternoon. Hello, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. May I say, in religious, updated, non-sexist language, a hearty A person to what you said about the drug war. You make more sense than most of the news reports I've heard altogether. My question has to do with, as I understood you, the kind of dissonance, difference between what Americans believe about themselves and what they what really happened, as you so aptly and eloquently pointed out about the Vietnam War. And it seems to me, just to turn a bit political, that during some of the last years, such tremendously important and vitally economic issues as flag burning and the Pledge of Allegiance and our current president's lack of service in Vietnam became such hot-button issues. And it seems to me, as you so aptly pointed out, we still struggle with this issue about wanting to believe in our own goodness, and when we see the realities, we seem to go into as great a case of denial as any alcoholic.
Yeah, I think, part of what made the Vietnam War happen was our belief that somehow we could make anything into what we wanted it to be just by describing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
As though human realities really were defined as public relations issues. And, we've, as a culture, have been stuck in that spot ever since. And we pretend that by going through the motions and saying all the right things about ourselves, that automatically makes it real, and have lost track of the fact that you get what you do. You don't get what you talk about.
Yes, yes,
you get what you do. And what we have done looks a whole lot different than what we imagine ourselves to be. And I don't think we have to approach that as though, we are horrible sinners and we have to flagellate ourselves.
No.
That's not the point.
No.
The real point is just to see things clearly, and so that we can make clear decisions. And in this case, we are 30 years after the fact, we are still sitting hung on the exact same moral dilemmas that we were then because of our own unwillingness to face up to what is a difficult realization about ourselves. Just the simple process of facing up would do enormous wonders for our democracy, I think.
Yes, I agree. May I make two more comments?
Sure.
It seems to me that, as I see in so much of life, the meaning and the power to label and describe carry with it terrific power. And I think in this particular thing, they certainly do. And also, are one of our greatest cultural weaknesses, we just seem to have no sense of history or who we are as a country. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think countries make legends about themselves, and they pass these legends on, and that part of the reason that I think an old subject like Vietnam still has to be processed by us is because it has to be incorporated into this legend we have of ourselves that we pass on, and it has to be done when there are still people around who can remember it, who had direct experience of it, so that we're not stuck as a culture, just simply trying to sort through, you know, ancient papers, trying to figure out what and who indeed we are. And I think that there's an enormous healing process that is available to us in honesty. That so many of the wounds that we recognize, everybody in the society recognizes, hang around from that war, could be healed by simply a strong dose of honesty applied by ourselves and pursued. I would like to see that culminate in a kind of apology. I think, we expect such things from other cultures, but we refuse to do such things ourselves. And I think it would make a great deal of sense for the United States of America to issue a formal apology to the people of Vietnam, saying we had no right to have gone there and done what we did, and that we're sorry we did so, and that we would try to make up for it, and to try and live up to some of the commitments that we made as part of the peace process more than 20 years ago. You know, we pledged ourselves to use our resources to help rebuild the damage that we had left behind in Southeast Asia. We haven't done a thing. We haven't spent a dime except as private individuals. We have not, as a society, done anything to make up for what's left, and what's left is still there. I mean, in Vietnam today, there are peasants blowing their feet off every day on American landmines. In Laos, they cannot even practice agriculture using water buffaloes because there is so much unexploded ordnance in the ground that they simply decimate their water buffalo population. In Cambodia, they estimate it'll take at least 10 years to collect all the old landmines that are left over from our own involvement there. So, you know, there are real concrete ways for us to take our consciousness of who we were and what we did and to apply it in the real world, and that we will benefit enormously by doing so, and we need to do so for our own sake.
We have another caller on line number one, and we'll go there next. Good afternoon.
Yes, very interesting. Your last statement about mines, U.S., the last time I heard anything about it, would not sign the treaty to go about and take all these things out of the ground, indicating we'll use them again. And in my opinion of the Vietnam and the parallels between that and the Gulf War, the U.S. government seemed to do what they had to do in order to spoon-feed the American public to buy that was just another capitalist war. Saddam Hussein was vilified for weeks, and then we go over and start bombing those innocent people to pieces, just like we did in Vietnam, and nothing seems to have been learned. And in my opinion, that we're at the last decaying stages of capitalist imperialism, which has no conscience and no artful soul about itself, and will continue to do these things until there is some sort of revolution to overthrow the world power structure that now holds this human society by the throat. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Well, I don't use words like capitalist imperialism very much, and I'm not sure about world revolution to overthrow the power structure, but I would agree with a couple things, the first being that we don't seem to have learned much from Vietnam as applied in the Gulf War. The one obvious lesson that we did learn was about public relations. They no longer let the press go out unfettered to watch what the troops are doing. They now make this guided tours that they are sure will show up on the evening news showing what they want to be shown about their war, and certainly the aftermath of the Gulf War has made that quite clear, you know, that the great cruise missile turns out to have been an extraordinary dud. All these great smart bombs that they used in the process turned out to have been meaningless. And, you know, in pure military terms, that they got far more return on their money from just the standard old hardware of war than they did from any of this electronic gizmos that they used to sell the war along the way and make it seem so clean and surgical. Second, I think that if you ever wanted to describe a capitalist war, a war undertaken purely for economic reasons, then I think the Gulf War is the best example that there is, perhaps the best in American history. This was a war that had only one rationale. You know, if Kuwait's principal product was broccoli, we never would have gotten near the place. We went there to fight for oil. It was a quite clear decision, which I think has enormous repercussions that we have not examined. You know, we live on a planet in which Americans are some 4 or 5% of the population consuming some 40% of the world's resources. Now, you know, if in as demands on those resources increase and the population of the world continues to double and double again, if our policy is going to be that we're going to fight for access to those resources, that in order to keep our Eldorados and our electric toothbrushes running, we're prepared to fight war after war after war, which is what the precedent of the Gulf War commits us to do, then we have gotten ourselves in some very serious business, because we're going to have to raise generation after generation of centurions in order to be able to carry this out. You know, the world is not going to accept our position of privilege. And until we find a way of addressing that kind of imbalance that increasingly is defining global affairs, we're going to be stuck with having to fight and fight and fight to maintain something that ought not to be ours in the first place. So, I think that the Vietnam War has a lot of lessons to teach us about that process, both about ourselves and about how the world operates.
We're talking this afternoon with David Harris. His book is Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us. It's published by Times Books. If you would like to join us, you can call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller on the toll-free line number 4, from Cicero, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Harris?
Yes.
Good to hear you. You just mentioned about this search for oil in the Middle East and us defending the Kuwaitis, and et cetera. Did you listen to NPR News this morning?
I didn't, I'm sorry to say, but...
Well, in brief, there is already a revelation that there's a good mother load of fuel in Turkmenistan and other areas. So I think that the stage is already set that once the Middle East is depleted, we're going to be sending out, you know, more troops to guard our interests in other parts of you know, Asia, as opposed to downgrading the size of our Cadillacs.
Yeah, it's this inability for us to reexamine the notion of what our interests are. I mean, you hear out of Washington every day statements that America is going to defend its interests, but there is no discussion of what those interests are.
Yeah, really.
And that's what the country needs, is a discussion of what is it in our interest to do. I think it's, I go to pick my child up from, my daughter up from school every day, and I stand in line, a long line of four-wheel drive vehicles, each one of which gets about 6 miles to a gallon,
right.
Driven by suburban housewives who drive through, a half inch of slush once a year in order to justify having this kind of vehicle. You know, it's crazy. It's not in our interest to have those things lined up. I mean, I wish we could drag a few dead soldiers who went out to fight for that oil and drop them there at the front of the line for everybody to drive by and understand just what the costs of these things are.
I'm afraid that the brainwashing is far too effective for people to make that connection ordinarily.
Well, I think we're certainly swimming upstream, but I think it's real important that we, A, not give up hope, and B, again, using the model of Vietnam, in 1965, if you would have said, look, there's going to be such a citizen uprising against this war that ultimately the government is going to have to find a way to get out of it, people would have laughed. Oh, this is impossible. You can't do this.
Yeah.
And we did it. That happened. I mean, in all the approximate and, all of its shortfall, and this wasn't exactly the way we wanted it to do, and there are lots of leftovers. But the fact of the matter is that because people were prepared to take their lives in their own hands and operate under the assumption that a democracy only works if the people itself carry out democracy, that it doesn't work because by handing it over to governmental functions, that there has to be a real democratic base for democracy to work. By taking those assumptions, we were able to change the course of American policy and divert us from doing an even greater evil than the evil that we did.
And there's one reason in particular that I was happy to know of you having written this book, and that is as a counterpoint to a book that came out from the Secretary of Defense during the Kennedy and Johnson administration?
Robert McNamara.
McNamara. And the reason I bring this book up is not only has he been a guest on NPR, but also because you had mentioned something that we ought to extend an apology to the Vietnamese. I think that's, although it's well, it's a good thought, and I think it's well deserved, the fact that McNamara would not even apologize to the mothers whose sons that he had sent to their demise, doesn't give me any hope that there's going to be any groundswell of an apology. And the fact is that if there's any kind of honor at all in a man like him, or perhaps other guys who were participants in this kind of a slaughter, they would take, you know, whatever money they have in their estate, and they would send it to Vietnam just alone to partake in digging up the landmines. But well, you never heard that from him.
No, you didn't. You know, again, if we if I were waiting for Robert McNamara to make all this stuff happen, we'd still be stuck somewhere 30 years ago. So,
exactly.
You know.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for your call. Well, what did you think when the McNamara book came out? You have some strong words about him in your book.
I thought two things. I thought, first, he did us all a service by saying it. I mean, I had always assumed that, you know, in his book he came out and basically said that by 1966, you know, he and the other people making these decisions understood that the war was a waste and that it shouldn't have been fought, and nonetheless proceeded with the war for another 7 years. But they had reached the conclusion at that point. And I had always assumed that that was the case, but to hear the architect of it come out explicitly and say that that was indeed the case, I think was helpful in terms of understanding exactly what went on, and that he did a service to the country by saying so. That said, I wonder, why didn't you say it then? You know, if Robert McNamara in 1966 had stood up and said what he says in his book today, that the war was a waste, that war would have been over in the space of a year. Robert McNamara was one of two people in the entire society whose sheer public statement to that effect could have turned the entire policy around. I mean, he was its architect. He was the guy. He was the man. And for him to have waited 29 years to say this, to me, is almost as great a crime as the commission in the first place. You know, that he knew these kids were being wasted, and he didn't even give them any warning. He didn't even have the heart to go out and tell them, look, you ought to better make a choice here because your life's not being well spent. And I think that puts blood on Robert McNamara's hands that he'll never be able to wash off. You know, and I respect him for trying to at least make some kind of amends for what he was a part of, and at least participate in that process. But that said, he could crawl on his knees from here to Lourdes and back, and it, as far as I'm concerned, still wouldn't clean him. You know, there's millions of people who are dead because he kept his mouth shut. And his logic was that he owed a debt of loyalty to his president, to whom he served, not to say this kind of thing publicly. Well, what did he owe the rest of us? He was our Secretary of Defense. What did he owe us? What about all those kids who died out there in the rice paddies, thinking that they were doing something that he knew they weren't? I think that's a kind of responsibility that is going to weigh heavily on Robert McNamara and ought to. I think that said, it's important for us to remember that we all have a piece of that responsibility. I mean, before we get on the case of Robert McNamara or Henry Kissinger or a number of other people we could list who had a much greater role in making this war happen than the rest of us did, we have to first acknowledge our own role in it. You know, this was done by our country, in our names, and even those of us who were against the war bear a piece of that action. It was ours. Let's claim it. Let's accept that this indeed was ours, and accept our own individual responsibility as part of that before we go on and then get on the case of Robert McNamara.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you've been involved in some work with some veterans groups, which I guess is somewhat unusual for somebody who was involved in the anti-war movement. Is that something that's
correct? Yeah, I'm probably the only draft resister I know of who sat on the board of a veterans organization, organization called Swords to Plowshares, which was one of the founders of this whole storefront veterans movement to set up treatment centers that were easily accessible to Vietnam veterans and to start addressing the issue of all the issues that were plaguing Vietnam veterans, but particularly the issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, and played a key role in getting the Veterans Administration to finally accept that there was indeed such a thing as post-traumatic stress disorder and begin to address it. But, I don't have a fight with the veterans.
I wanted to know was, how, you know, was there an acceptance problem in you being involved, having been an anti-war protester, because as we talked about earlier in the show, there's always this conflict between, well, you can't be against the war and be for the warrior.
Well, you know, I think that there's, you know, that's for some people, that's obviously an issue that sticks in their craw. And, you know, there's certainly people out there who are veterans who will not accept me and what I did. My experience in the work I did, however, was that wasn't a generalized phenomenon, and that in fact combat veterans and draft resistors who went to prison had a lot in common. Both of us had been through the experience of paying prices during that war, and one of the central divisions between people in that war was who paid prices and who didn't. And you know, I found that we were able to talk to each other about what our experiences were and have mutual respect. You know, I think that because we were unwilling to face up directly to the issues of the war, one of the things that happened was that implicitly we ended up blaming the veterans for it without ever articulating that. We simply, you know, we were so abhorred by the war, or we were so disgusted with the war, we didn't want to hear about it, so we just ignored veterans who came home and needed to be heard and needed to be dealt with. And we didn't deal with them for years because of that. And I think that was totally inappropriate. I think there are veterans who have a lot to answer for. Don't get me wrong. All of us have got to stand up for the things that we did during that period of time. And there are veterans out there who did things that they are ashamed of and ought to be ashamed of, and that can't simply be foisted off on the policy. But all of us share the mutual responsibility for the policy itself. We sent those guys out there to do that, and it's not fair for us to then force them to take the brunt of the blame for the fact the war happened in the first place. Rather, I think we have to find some common ground that we can all use to heal each other.
I assume you visited the Vietnam Memorial in Washington.
I have. You know, I think it's the best public monument the United States has ever built. That speaks as directly to what the pain of that experience was as any inanimate object could.
Finally, do you feel, now that you've written this book, that you've sort of gotten some of these off your chest and reached sort of a personal reckoning for yourself, maybe, with some of these things?
Well, I've always felt, you know, that I, you know, was a lot further along at making my peace with this than most people, because I dealt with it at the time. You know, having done my bit back then and refused to be part of it when it was going on, you know, has helped me come to terms with it. But, you know, I think for me, not just wanting to make the personal expression, but also, you know, after watching 20 years worth of revisionism come down the line since the war has been over, I wanted to at least have out there on the record, hold on. You know, this was not what the war was about. This was not just some abstract piece of foreign policy. You know, this was not just some casual mistake. This was a whole order beyond that. And I wanted to at least have that out on the public record so that those people who are trying to understand have a chance to hear that part of it as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. It's been a pleasure.
It's been mine. And have a Merry Christmas.
You too. David Harris is the author of Our War, What We Did in Vietnam and What It Did to Us. It's published in hardback by Times Books.